From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The demand for vaccine is already overwhelming the supply. You should be prepared to wait.
My main word for you is patience.
With vaccine shipments from Pfizer and Moderna hopefully increasing in the coming weeks and months, with new vaccines potentially receiving approval from the FDA, and with an organized whole of government effort by the new president's administration, gradually as we move through the spring, we will see meaningful reductions in COVID illnesses and death.
Illinois is about to move into a new phase for COVID-19 vaccinations that includes specific frontline workers and those 65 and older. But the vaccine rollout has been going slower than expected. Also, all 11 regions in Illinois have now moved out of Tier 3 mitigations, so the trend seems to be our friend at this moment. We'll also be talking about a new president and what that might mean for Illinois, all ahead here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois Government and Politics reporter. And joining us today, Mark Maxwell, the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV. And Mark, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Hannah, I'll go to you first. I mentioned how the coronavirus data seems to be going in the right direction as of now. And as of Friday morning, all of the state is now in what is known as Tier 2. I know that's a bit confusing for some to keep up with these different changing mitigations. So from that standpoint, what does this move mean for the state of Illinois?
Actually, I mean, some of Illinois is still in Tier 2, but really all what happened is that last Friday, the governor unfroze the entire state from being in so-called Tier 3 mitigations. And in the last week, a ton of regions have moved to different places depending on their, pretty rapidly falling metrics. And some regions are all the way back into regular phase 4, which is, you know, basically where we were last summer. And then some regions are in so-called Tier 1 mitigations, and the governor changed those so that they allow indoor dining. And I know it's confusing. I have a clarifying story at our website, nprillinois.org. But, what it means is that businesses are able to open up, and especially those, food and bars, establishments that have been struggling since the beginning of the pandemic. It's just been an absolutely brutal year for hospitality. But, you know, other places that have been closed in, you know, under those so-called Tier 3 mitigations, places like museums and bowling alleys and movie theaters, even gyms under Tier 3, you couldn't technically have group fitness classes, though I know a lot of places just weren't paying attention to that. But, like, you know, it means more economic activity. And that's obviously a good thing for those businesses and for the economy. But, people are still monitoring what will happen in a few weeks' time, you know, because of this increased activity in human contact. We'll see. And we also, when the governor announced, you know, he was going to unfreeze these, all the regions of the state, it was the same day as public health officials in Chicago confirmed that they had found the first case of the UK variant of coronavirus, and that's this much more contagious variant. And so, you know, though it's not any more deadly, it's still more contagious, meaning that it could make cases and hospitalizations and all of that go way up. So it's nothing to be trifled with. And I just, you know, but the governor's office, they got just hammered for freezing all the regions of the state into these Tier 3 mitigations through the holiday season. And so I think they made the calculation that they had to, you know, unfreeze and actually follow their own plan for, you know, no matter what happens with this new variant, or else they're going to, they're obviously not a very popular bunch throughout the state right now. And I think they had to follow their plan.
Yeah, Mark, how unpopular has the governor been over these last few months with some people? I know a lot of business groups. We've had the IHSA and people who want to see high school sports get back going once again. A lot of people want schools to reopen. And you know, he's been out there. I would give him credit. He has stuck to his guns on what he feels needs to be done and followed these public health guidelines.
One Republican, powerful Republican commented to me in a private conversation that every restaurant in the state, regardless of their political ideology, will want to host a fundraiser for the Republican running for governor in 2022. There is a strong sentiment in the business community. They've been sort of neglected or sort of just subjected to rules that I can't say the Pritzker administration has stayed consistent on. It's a difficult challenge to address the different regions and the, monitor all the different numbers, no doubt. But at one point heading into the holidays, the Pritzker administration said, forget that regional plan. We're going back to a statewide plan. Everyone's under these restrictions all at once. And then they started saying, well, let's wait the 2-week incubation period after the holidays. And remember back in the summer when we started to relax from those different regional restrictions, it happened. You couldn't just pass go like in the Monopoly game. You had to wait for a few weeks until you can graduate to this next phase. Well, now they're just accelerating everybody through tier one, tier two, tier three, phase four, and it feels like there's just it almost feels like there's an exhaustion in the Pritzker administration of trying to enforce all this, trying to keep up with it. It's almost like someone in the governor's office just took their big blueprint and their plan and just sort of crumpled it up into a ball and threw it in the trash can and said, let everybody out of the restrictions, at least to phase four. The vaccine's here. We're getting closer. That's kind of the sense that you get. They're clearly tired of having this big public fight with all the businesses, and they're hoping that the coronavirus surges we saw in the spring and in the fall and winter don't happen again in 2021. But, you know, right now we're in that phase of relaxing, and I think society at large is eager to get back to some semblance of normal.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on that?
I would throw in that there was a poll taken where 60% of the respondents thought that they were had a favorable opinion of how Governor Pritzker was handling the epidemic. Now, granted, I'm sure that all those people polled were not restaurant owners, but I would guess that the general public is probably still pretty much in favor of this idea of trying to restrict activities to limit the spread of the COVID virus. And if I'm not mistaken, when the new protocols were announced, Illinois had like 2 weeks in a row of declining positivity rates. And I suspect that what is going to happen with a new push at the federal level to kind of coordinate the production, distribution of vaccines, we're going to keep moving forward. And as more people get vaccinated, the economy will be able to open up to a much greater extent.
Well, Hannah, the vaccinations are a good segue into something else we had discussed earlier this week, and that was how difficult it has been for some people to navigate this process of getting appointments for the vaccine, of kind of understanding when those are going to be available in their area. I think you've had some issues dealing with that yourself.
That's right. I mean, it's been a very difficult process for, you know, Illinois will officially move into phase 1B of the vaccine distribution plan on Monday, though some counties have already been technically, you know, giving vaccines to people in that phase for a week or two. What phase 1B means is essential workers that are non-healthcare related and people over age 65. And it's been, I mean, so my parents are both over 65 and, you know, I felt like, oh, I know what's going on. I've been reporting on this stuff for months and months, but no, I had to find out from a neighbor that actually, you know, we could get them some appointments for a vaccine right now, right away through Walgreens. And, you know, that's just been a common sentiment of a lot of senior citizens. I spoke with AARP Illinois State Director Bob Gallo yesterday, And, you know, his broader point was, you know, there's a lot of this getting a vaccine appointment that depends on being computer literate, having internet access, or, you know, having children or anyone else who can help you that do have those things. And it's just been overall confusing. You know, teachers are in this new phase too, but not all school districts have been, what would you say, like proactive about providing information or setting up things through the local county health departments. So, I mean, it's been very messy. And I mean, I should note, we are taping this on Friday morning prior to another Governor Pritzker press conference. So possibly he'll make a big announcement about some central entry point for the whole state. But, you know, as of now, it's been pretty ad hoc. People have to rely on their employers, their healthcare providers, and that's been, you know, very uneven among healthcare providers, whether they're reaching out to the patients or not, or pharmacies, or, you know, their local county health departments. And that's just been very uneven from county to county.
One of the big problems is that there's just not enough vaccine to go around. There's a story in the local paper today how one of our hospitals has stopped being able to vaccinate people because they've run out of vaccines. The same thing with the Sangamon County Public Health Department. You can go online and go to sign up for an appointment, and they say no appointments are available, and they don't expect to be able to help anyone until they can get more vaccine. So I'm hopeful that at the federal level, we've got people who are going to be taking this a lot more seriously and are going to marshal the nation's resources to get the vaccines out and into the arms of the people who need them.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Mark Maxwell with WCIA-TV. And Mark, the governor made what I think some would consider to be a controversial decision, the Pritzker administration moving prisoners up in the ranks for getting the vaccines ahead of some others. Talk about that. I know you covered that story.
Sure. It stems from the issue Charlie just mentioned. There's a high demand for the vaccine and a really short supply. If there were more vaccinations available, more doses, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But governors across the country are making difficult medical ethical decisions about who should go first in line and who should have to wait a little bit longer. Nobody really complained when governors across the country and the CDC recommended healthcare workers fighting COVID-19 on the front lines and the elderly living in long-term care facilities should be first in line for those first doses of the vaccine. It's that second wave and what they're calling phase 1B that is becoming somewhat more controversial. At the start, there's a state document that had sort of buried inmates, prison inmates, down below phase 2, 3 or 4 different allocations or distributions of the vaccination below where they ended up landing, which was in that second phase, phase 1B. Of course, we should note prisons have been major hotspots for viral spread because of their close living quarters and their difficulty to keep sanitized in those confined situations. The virus has spread in prisons quite a lot. But that phase 1B was supposed to initially be for essential workers on the front lines. These are police, firefighters, National Guard, people in that category, and people working in meat packing plants, basically anyone who can't distance themselves. And if you take them off the job, a supply chain falls apart. The economy starts to crumble. That was the focus. Behind them is another important category in 1C. These are high-risk medical condition patients, people that are above 65 years old, who, of course, we know have a higher death rate if they get infected, and people with COPD or with cancer or with some big medical condition where if they too, even if they're in their 40s or 30s, if they get COVID-19, their life is very much at risk. So Republicans attacked the Pritzker administration for saying, how dare he put a convicted, you know, healthy, you know, murderer who's in his 20s ahead in line of a 57-year-old cancer patient or a 63-year-old COPD patient. So, you know, they're making the medical ethical argument, and there's certainly some politics at play there, but there is a public health question about do you target the hot spots first and make sure that this thing, the spread is contained as we try to save lives? It's a difficult decision, but that's where some of the controversy came from.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on that? I mean, I think most people can understand the public health side of it. They can also understand the political argument. That's a tough position.
Yeah, and it occurs to me that were there a situation where that 20-year-old convicted murderer were locked up, isolated in a cage where he never had any contact with another human being, that would be one thing. But as Mark said, you don't have the ability to social distance in a prison setting. Plus, all those guards go in and work with the inmates. Then they go back home to their communities, to their families. And some of the guards would have older parents, aunts and uncles, relatives with medical conditions. And so the idea, I think, is to try and eliminate the ability for the virus to easily spread among a large group of people in a concentrating setting where you can't practice social distancing and where there are also people who will bring that virus outside of that concentrated setting. So I think it makes good sense. And I say that as somebody who maybe is not going to be able to get a vaccine right away because that 20-year-old murderer is going to get one.
Charlie, something else let's talk about here for a moment. The Illinois House, of course, did not meet at the state capitol building when they were in session here earlier this month. They again rented out the downtown convention center in Springfield, known as the Bank of Springfield Center, and they conducted their business there. But now we've learned just how much it cost for them to be there, not only in January, but also back in May when they did the same thing to wrap up the spring session. Quite costly. Was this a good move for the state and for the Illinois House especially? And what are their other options there?
I think what jumped out at me out of the information that the AP wrote in the story, John O'Connor, that it was roughly $331,000 spent in May and then again here in January, that the $92,000 of it was for catered, boxed lunches and dinners. And I'm thinking to myself, and you may have seen, and Hannah, you would post them every day. Here's the menu of what their options were. And it struck me that we could probably have gotten along just as well getting them, I don't know, tacos or maybe just going to McDonald's or IHOP or somewhere instead of getting these kind of gourmet meals. That maybe would have cut it back a lot. And I don't know if there would have been opportunities to use the Capitol, use the House chamber in a similar fashion the way the Senate did, where they would have only a limited number of people actually on the floor at any one time, and they would, when it was time to vote, they would vote in waves. Now, the Senate offices are mostly in the Capitol. The House offices are mostly across the street in the Stratton building, so it would have been time, would have taken time for people to come back and forth. But maybe that is something that could have been explored.
And Hannah, you thought that maybe that wasn't going to work.
Well, I mean, it's difficult. Like, clearly they need to get back in the Capitol at some point. I think just from a public perception standpoint, the more stories that are done about, oh, they're, you know, spending $30,000 a day on X, Y, and Z, you know, it doesn't look good, especially because the legislature hasn't been in. Prior to going in early January, they hadn't met for 230 days. But the Senate is able to use their Capitol chambers. I mean, it's just a much smaller body. There's 59 senators. That also means less staff. They're able to, you know, they passed a rule back in the spring so they could do some more remote legislating. The House hasn't done that. In fact, I mean, there was a bill ready to go, to have remote legislating for the entire General Assembly, and it wasn't even touched during a lame duck session. There are more logistical challenges for the House because there are just more members. Their offices are mostly across the way in the Stratton Building, everyone's favorite beautiful mid-century government building. Whereas the Senate, you know, they can jump to and from the chambers back to their offices in much shorter periods of time. It's all just logistical challenges. That being said, you know, they need to figure it out ASAP because, you know, again, public perception, but they want to do good. They want to pass laws. They want to be involved. I mean, hell, like this entire time, so many, not just Republicans, but lots of Democrats too, have been complaining about, you know, not being able to be involved in the governor just ruling by executive order. And now that they have this chance, they better take it. They better, you know, pass that remote legislating bill in whatever form is acceptable to the most amount of people. And, you know, they better hit the ground running.
Before time gets away from us, I want to switch gears on probably the big story of the week, which was there's a new president. Joe Biden was officially sworn in this week. And Mark, when it comes to the state of Illinois, it's been no secret that not only the state and the city of Chicago did not necessarily get along well with former President Donald Trump. Most expect this to be a better relationship, but what could it really mean when it comes to concrete type of changes for the state of Illinois? What does the Biden administration mean for Illinois?
Well, I don't know about changes right off the bat, but the biggest impact would certainly be the $350 billion that President Biden has promised to state and local governments across the country in his COVID relief package. Can it get through the Senate? Maybe. We'll see. I would just point out, though, that the Congress is working. They have 535 members between senators and members of Congress. They're working. They're in their regular office buildings. They're in their space. You know, we didn't even talk about the idea of putting members in the House up in the gallery on that second floor and spreading out. There's tons of space. Their offices are no farther away than they were before COVID. And there's plenty of space. This is all about legislators and their fear of showing up to do their jobs. It's about their fear of COVID-19. And those are reasonable concerns. But there are several ways, whether that's remote legislating, whether it's showing up and taking time or waves, there's several ways for them to do their jobs. And they just, enough of them had such strong concerns that they just sort of didn't show up for a long time.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on, of course, we could get into a long discussion about, you know, the best ways to house the Illinois legislature during this session. But I do want to keep on the Biden discussion here. And
I would say probably the biggest thing is that it's going to be a godsend in terms of the state's financial picture. It's pretty clear in my mind that we are going to do another COVID relief bill at the national level. And the amount of money being allocated for state and local governments has varied. The House some months ago passed $1 trillion for state and locals to make up for lost revenue. That's not going to happen. The most recent thing I saw from the Biden administration was roughly $350 billion. That is probably going to get scaled back. A number is maybe $200 billion to state and local governments. And what might that mean for Illinois? Well, the Tax Foundation in December did an analysis based on the $160 billion for state and local governments that that bipartisan Senate coalition had put together. And they said, if you use the same criteria that was in the earlier HEROES Act, Illinois' share would be roughly $6.3 billion. If you base it just on unemployment, Illinois' share would be $6.2 billion. If you do it by population, Illinois would get $6 billion. And so it seems likely there's going to be a huge chunk of federal money coming to the state. Now, not all that money is obviously for the state government. It will be shared with the locals, but a significant portion of it can go right into the state coffers, and that's going to go a long way, I think, to solving the state's fiscal problems, at least temporarily, while we work on a longer-term solution.
Charlie, just about 10 seconds here, but does that change the need for a tax increase that some had been expecting?
I think it changes the need for it immediately, and I think it also would provide the state with an alternative to try and having to push through that decoupling from the federal tax breaks for businesses, which the business community has been very much opposed to, and which would save hundreds of millions of dollars for the state if we were to decouple from the federal tax structure for business.
All right, let's go to our notes from the field. Hannah, let's start with you.
Sure. Heather Staines, who has been in the Senate representing Northside Chicago for almost 13 years, announced that she's resigning later this month. And that follows the resignation of Andy Menar from this area, in the Springfield area, to go work for the governor's office. And I can't help but like trace so many high profile departures from the General Assembly back to the summer of 2017 after the budget impasse broke. You know, just so many departures, so many years of experience. Obviously, it's always good to have fresh blood, but it is also sad to see people feeling like public service is just, it's too hard in some cases. Obviously, everyone's situation is different, but just interesting to me.
All right, Mark?
Yeah, you might call it term limits by another method, just the intense public pressure. I'll dovetail on Hannah's note. This is maybe an inside baseball observation, but the Senate president and minority leader, Don Harmon, the Democrat, and Dan McConkey, the Republican, announced in a joint statement that they would cancel the first week of session that was supposed to be scheduled for next week. You don't normally see that. In the House, often the Speaker's chief of staff would just alert the members. They wouldn't really tell the press. It would just sort of leak out. Sometimes Republicans would find out last. It's interesting. The reason I point that out, there seems to be a change in alliance or alignment, rather, of power in the Senate, as several of the people who ran against or tried to organize against Don Harmon's election as president last year in 2019, or leading up to 2020, rather, they're now out, Senators Menar and Staines. And that's because they were on top of the budget process. They chaired the Appropriations Committee, and Harmon sort of consolidated or stripped them of some of that power. That's one of the reasons perhaps they might have left. And you're seeing at least what appears to be more coordination between the Republican and Democratic leaders there in the Senate. What does that bode for Illinois? Don't quite know yet, but it's just interesting to watch that happen as Don Harmon takes shape of the Senate and starts to remake it in his image.
All right, and Charlie.
Well, even though Michael Madigan may not be the Speaker of the House any longer, he is still a target of that U.S. Attorney's probe into ComEd's admitted attempts to bribe him. And in campaign finance reports published at the close of 2020, we learned that the friends of Michael J. Madigan spent $1 million, more than $1 million, on legal fees during the last 3 months of 2020. And that had to do with the special investigating committee subpoenaing documents from the U.S. Attorney's Office, documents involved in the civil case filed against ComEd and by extension Madigan. And so I'm sure that that's a lot of money. But at the end of the year, his fund also reported $13.4 million still on hand, which he is legally allowed to spend on legal fees.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Mark Maxwell with WCIA-TV. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app, and production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.